Hello, I'm Russell Michaels. Thank you for joining me and welcome to Cine Politics, where we discuss the social and, of course, the political issues which have inspired all kinds of films and documentaries from all around the world. And on today's programme, we're discussing the intriguing documentary The Oath by filmmaker Laura Poitras. Her film tells the story of two brothers-in-law, Abu Jandal, Osama bin Laden's former bodyguard, and Salim Hamdan, who worked as bin Laden's driver and became a prisoner at Guantanamo. The film follows Abu Jandal's life in Yemen as a family man and taxi driver, and after 7 years in Guantanamo, Salim became the first man to face the Pentagon's controversial military tribunals. We only hear from Salim Hamdan through his letters, as the film charts his case against the Bush administration, famously known as Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. Meanwhile, the filmmaker constructs a three-dimensional portrait of Abu Jandal as a former Al-Qaeda member who is haunted by feelings of guilt for his role in his brother-in-law's fate. But is Abu a truly reformed character, and has he really renounced the oath he took when he joined Al-Qaeda?
ما تدخل منها كنت دائما حدفه بعيد. اذكر سالم والله قلبي يوجعني. فكنت تقول في نفسي ايش اقول، المفروض الاب الحقيقي يكون موجود في هذا المكان الان اللي هو سالم ذاته. لكن في مساله مهمه جدا، في الانسان مثلا يكون مرت على اخطاء في حياته كثيره جدا ويندم على مواقف كثيره في حياته، لكن ما انا ندمان على شيء زي ما ندمان على سالم حمدان. والله هرب منهم وأوقات كثيرة، يعني إيه اللي اتصلوا بتعاول الآن الحين يجمع كثير بعد ما أروح بيت عمي. البنات بيجون عادي بيلعبون معي خال وبيلعبون فوق وزي كذا، لكن أنا ما أنا متحمل. تخيل مثلا لو مات في جوانتانامو مثلا وبناته سألوني قالوا خالو ناصر قالوا بابا كيف دخل كيف راح كوبا، إيش بقول لهم؟ بقول لهم تحت راسي.
How close were you to Osama bin Laden when you were with him?
A meter to a meter and a half away at most.
And what kind of weapon did you carry?
I had my own gun, but there was also a special gun to be used if Sheikh Osama bin Laden was attacked and we were unable to save him, in which case I would have to kill him.
So what is the difference between the man Abu Jandal was when he took the Al-Qaeda oath and when he gave intelligence to the American government after September the 11th, and Abu Jandal as he is today? Well, here to discuss the oath are my guests: Andy Worthington, author of the book The Guantanamo Files, and he works with the human rights group Cage Prisoners. And we also have Mike McCahill, film critic from the Sunday Telegraph. Ring warm welcome to the programme to both of you. To start with you, Mike, intriguing title, The Oath. I didn't know there was an oath taken to join Al-Qaeda, but what are the contexts? Everyone in this film has different loyalties, it seems.
Yeah, and Abu Jandal is this extraordinarily ambiguous figure, which makes him the perfect subject for any documentarist. He's riven with contradictions, he's riddled with guilt. You spend a good deal of the 90 minutes of the film trying to get a handle on him. I'm not quite sure whether we entirely do by the end of the film. His problem seems to be that while he's prepared to reject mainstream politics and the American way of thinking, he can't quite bring himself to pledge his allegiance to the Al-Qaeda cause, in part because this oath demands a sort of total unthinking subservience. And the kind of character he is, sort of garrulous and loudmouthed, in many ways he's the perfect taxi driver. He can't quite bring himself to commit to that. And so he becomes this sort of strangely rootless figure, almost literally so, in the way that he's driving this cab around, going round and round and round.
Now, and we should say he has been a very important figure to the American government. So, Andy, what kind of level of intelligence did he provide when he was taken for interrogation after the US coal was bombed?
Well, I don't know how much he provided at that point. I think what's interesting is the information that he provided after the September 11th attacks. And it kind of seems pretty crucial to me that the conflict within Abu Jandal seems to be about, on the one hand, understanding that the United States is waging a war on the Muslim world and that it's required to fight back. But on the other hand, what appears to be, you know, very honestly, a revulsion at civilian terrorist attacks on civilians.
Right.
And then certainly the way the narrative is explained in the film is that, you know, he knew the September 11th hijackers in Afghanistan. But yeah. He didn't know that what they'd done because he left Al-Qaeda in 2000.
He was actually in prison when September 11th happened.
Yeah, and then the FBI the week after came to interrogate him and you know, showed him the photos and then went, these are the guys who did it. And that he broke down, he couldn't handle it, and that he started talking to them. So he was a huge source of information about Al-Qaeda. Now, in the film, it says that the United States delayed the invasion of Afghanistan to accommodate this information that he was coming out with, which doesn't sound plausible to me.
I don't know that.
It was, well, you know...
Let me just ask Mike, since Salim is missing from the film, what does that do, briefly, to the film? Because we're watching Abu Salim's in prison. One's freedom is amplifying the other's kind of incarceration.
Yeah, it makes it an unusual documentary in that we have one very prominent character who, like I said, we can't quite get a handle on, can't quite get a fix on, who is always on the move, either ideologically or literally, in terms of what he does in his day job. And then we have another character who's only there in the form of these letters. For me, they were the sort of emotional backbone at the film. They were the through line that carried you through.
Okay, well, let's pause there and see a clip where, after 7 years, the pre-trial phase of Salim Hamdan's military tribunal begins at Guantanamo.
إن القانون الدولي واضح. إن الدستور واضح. فتحت أي قانون تحاكمونني. إن الطريق واضح. إن الطريق صريح فإذا عرجتم لليمين أو لليسار فستخطئون كونوا صادقين أنا أريد القانون أنا أريد العدل فقط لا غير.
We look forward to in the military commission's process defending Mr. Hamdan and proving that he is in fact a driver and a mechanic before the commission. And with that, we can take any of your questions.
Would you further elucidate on what you mean by describing him as a driver and mechanic?
Well, that he's a driver and mechanic, not a member of Al-Qaeda, and not guilty of materially supporting terrorism.
Does that mean you anticipate him being acquitted here?
Bill, I think what I said in court, I don't know, an hour ago is the case. This trial is going to be deficient. It is going to proceed, but it's not going to be full, open, and fair, as the government has alleged. There are fundamental flaws in this system.
Fundamental flaws in the system, Andy. The military tribunals, if the Supreme Court declared they were illegal in 2006, that they exceeded the president's authority, how come they're still policy now?
Well, because they were revived later, a few months later, by Congress, which they changed the rules slightly. They tried to make them slightly less about being able to launder information derived through torture, which was certainly what Dick Cheney had in mind when they were first set up. But they ended up with Congress creating war crimes that were not war crimes previously. So material support for terrorism is something that has a tradition of being prosecuted in federal courts, but absolutely not in the military commission system that has been used in America's
past. And the difference is limited evidence, secret testimony. Well, in the military tribunals.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain amount of difference. I mean, actually, since President Obama brought them back again and revised them and tinkered with them even more, they're much more closely related to what would apply in a federal court.
Okay.
But the problem is that they kind of look similar, but they're dealing with invented war crimes. That's the huge problem with them, is that everything that they're trying was invented by Congress.
And just so we're clear, Salim Hamdan was a driver And therefore, because he was a driver for Osama bin Laden, he was a terrorist in the eyes of the prosecutors. Well, Mike, the American there, who's obviously sworn an oath of allegiance to his constitution, he is defending Hamdan, the Muslim accused of being a terrorist. So what do you make of that character in this film?
Well, one of the strengths of the film is that it's a documentary that shows rather than tells. There's no voiceover, for example, so a lot of its drama plays out on human faces. You saw there in the clip just what a hard time that a figure who notionally looks like an insider, he has the military dress on, just what a hard time that he's having with this case. There is a sense that, to some degrees, his own hands have been tied by this, and it requires extraordinary measures on the part of
He seems like he's being very careful about what he says as well. Like,
exactly.
In some ways, what he isn't saying is the story.
That's the, you know, the subtext is all there. One of the subtexts of the film is about individuals within systems, and here is a man who is as much a prisoner of the American justice legal system as Salim is.
And I think maybe the fight with Americans trying to bring, you know, improve the justice system isn't that well known. Mm-hmm. I've got a quote here for you, Andy. The filmmaker says, in an interview, if we went into a coma on September the 10th, 2001, and woke up today, we wouldn't recognize this country. Where does Obama, briefly, where does he fit into the military tribunals now? What has it got better or worse?
Well, you know, it's got better to the extent that he's tinkered with them even more with the aid of Congress so that they resemble much more closely the kind of procedures in a federal court. But he has the problem of still being lumbered with fake war crimes. He should never have brought back military commissions. It's really that simple. Crimes that involve terrorism can be tried in federal court. There's a long history of it. Everybody else who's in Guantanamo, who's a soldier, should be held until the end of hostilities. There's no reason for having created any extra category. And certainly, you know, prosecuting Salim Hamdan, who's a driver. The great comment that was made at the time was, you know, they didn't try and do this with Adolf Hitler's driver after the Second World War.
Right. OK, well, we must pause there and see a clip where Abu Jandal is caught on camera when Osama bin Laden spoke to followers in January 2000. And then, in the present day, the film asks him a very sensitive question.
Allahumma kama wasaftana للجهاد في سبيلك في أفغانستان التي نحن عليها اليوم وللجهاد في سبيلك ضد الأمريكان ومن سايعهم ومن عاونهم فنسألك بأسمائك الحسنى وصفاتك العلى أن تثبتنا على هذا الطريق حتى نلقاك وأنت راض عنا.
Would you say yes, I would?
To participate in that?
In this operation.
She asked you now.
لا ما اسمعش
ما شاء الله الان تسالك الان انه اذا سالك اسامه بن لادن انك تشارك بهذه العمليه بتشارك فيها ولا لا؟
انا؟ لا
يعني هذا السؤال انت حر في الاجابه.
انا لا لن اشارك في هذه العمليات.
He said no. If he اسامه بن لادن asked him to participate, he will not.
واي وانت قاعد سالها بيجي اصلا بعده على طول لسبب واحد. انا اتكلم عن ناصر البحري الان بحكم انه سؤالها سؤال صحفي فسيكون اجابه ناصر البحري وليس اجابه واحد يحمل فل. انا قناعتي الشخصيه انه واجب في ميدان معركه جندي لجندي ولا ما كنت عاجز ممكن اتقدم للشيخ وسام اقول ممكن اكون من ضمن المنفذين في اي عمليه استشهاديه كانت في نيروبي دار السلام كانت في كول كانت في اي مكان استطيع اطلب والشيخ حسين يردني بل عندي القدره اني اخطط وانفذ عمليه ولكن قناعاتي الشخصية أني واجه في ساحة معركة ومعرفتي بعقلية أن الشيخ أسامة كان يقول لن نستطيع الاستمرار في عمليات نوعية لا بد أن نواجه أمريكا في كذا ضربة حتى نسحبها لساحة قتال مواجهة.
أدري لما تكلمت عنه لما سألتك سؤال حساس وقالت لك
جواب هذا الشرجع في ظهور الشيخ
هذا
ما
عندي بصراحة أنا جاي أذكرك على هذا
الكلام أنا حتى نفسه قربع في راسي من ذيك الساعة أشيت حذفه.
Mike, this is quite a startling moment in the film where it certainly forced me to reevaluate at least what he wanted on camera. Did this change your view of Abu himself?
Not particularly. I mean, it, f- for me, it confirmed the sense that he was a slippery character. And it did make me think that maybe it's that slipperiness that led the FBI to close the file on him as early as they did. I will say this in his favour. When he speaks about how upset he was on learning that many of his acquaintances were involved in the 9/11 attacks, there was a kind of human response there that would seem to preclude him having a career as a suicide bomber. The fact that he's willing to shed tears for a sort of needless loss of life makes him a much more human character.
Well, Andy, what's your reaction? Do you think that he was kind of lying or not being honest the first time, or do you think he's afraid of what he says in another part of the film, threats against his life for certain statements he has made publicly?
Well, that's what I felt. I felt the latter. I felt that he didn't want that to be out there because it would make him a target. You know, I could be wrong. I mean, the conflict that I saw in him was less about what was actually involved in being in Al-Qaeda, because he seemed quite clear that he was... I thought the battlefield analogy worked really well, that he wanted to fight on the battlefield. He wanted to fight Americans on a battlefield, but he didn't want to be involved in terrorism and kill civilians.
Yeah.
And that's quite interesting in the sense that, actually, I think that what Osama bin Laden hoped was to draw the Americans into a battle in Afghanistan, man-to-man. It didn't turn out that way.
Yeah.
Ludicrously, I think he anticipated that the Americans would come and they would fight them man-to-man on the battlefield. It didn't happen. But it seemed convincing to me, you know.
It's a strange moment in any documentary for somebody to say, please delete what I just said. But Mike, if we're looking from another point of view, what do we learn about Al-Qaeda recruits, at least when he and his brother-in-law began their kind of mission?
Well, one of the things the film does is it debunks the myth that people are being press-ganged into following the Al-Qaeda cause, or that the decision to sign up and take this oath is made on the spur of the minute with a rush of blood to the head. There's a degree of personal choice involved. There's an anecdote very early on in the film where Abu Jandal is talking to his young son and saying, what do you want to be when you grow up? Do you want to be a mechanic or a jihadist? Which seems to me like a fairly limited career choice. But the son says that he wants to be a jihadist, and Abu Jandal says, well, you do realise you're making a lot of trouble for yourself. But the element of choice is central here. And also, the degree of personal feeling involved, I think, is at the heart of the film. Abu Jandal says that he found a degree of warmth in Osama bin Laden that his own father didn't show him. So there's a need for sort of affirmation from one's elders there, maybe.
One thing I learned was that if you are captured, then 72 hours pass and you can say anything because a cell will have evaporated, dispersed by that point. And so there's a kind of safety mechanism. I didn't know that before. Well, let's see our last clip, where Abu Jandal holds a regular meeting with young Yemeni students who ask his advice about politics and ethics.
هل هذا يعتبر خطر علينا مثلا من الحكومه من
الFBI؟
لا لا من الحكومه اليمنيه من اي حكومه مثلاً.
في بعض الاحيان يضطر الانسان انه يرد على السؤال بسؤال حتى يفهم المغزى
صح
انا بديك جواب كان واضح مثلا بعطيك سؤال حتى تختصر علمتكم ايش؟
اداره
الوقت ايوه
اولويات الوقت
الرساله والرؤيه رسم الاهداف في الحياه
نعم
هل يوم قلت لك فجر ولا تعال بديك الدوره الفلانيه ولا افغانستان والعراق
ما هذه
أبداً أنا ضد فكرة عبي شاوش حنحمل الباص ويردها في الجهاد ضد الفكرة هذه تماماً ضد هذا من أي معرف نفسي الجهاد ضد الفكرة هذه يخرج بالقناعات ويتحمل التبعات فأنا هذا كلمتي لك أنت ولأمين وكل الشباب مسألة الجهاد ربوا أنفسكم هيو أنفسكم المعركة قادمة رضيتم ولا أبيتم ستفرض صفر عليكم أمريكا بوش جاء يفرض على الناس كل معركة لكن أقل شيء تمام نريد الطبيب والواعي كان الشيخ حسام يقول كان يقول لازم نطلع كلنا قال الدانة كلنا نطلع صاروخ كان نشتي الزناد ونشتي البقاعدة ونشتي السبطانة ونشتي الدربين ونشتي الراصد ونشتي فنحن نكون بحاجة للطبيب وبحاجة للعالم والداعية والواعظ بحاجة لهذا كله
نهب اقتصاد
لازم كلنا نقرح ولازم كلنا استشهاديين ولازم كلنا بالتي ان تي والسي 4
I found that a fascinating moment, Mike. I'll come back to your reaction for what he says there. But first, Andy, in another part of the film, Abu is concerned, he says, about the younger generation coming up as a potential Al-Qaeda recruit. He says they're not guided by Al-Qaeda's original goals. What's he really worried about there? Next generation of what?
Well, of jihadists, you know, of people who, I presume, he's talking about people who are prepared to commit terrorist attacks and are not even targeting them specifically. I mean, I think he mentions...
Not following the code, maybe.
Yeah, well, and that any Western target will, they regard as legitimate, I think is what he says at some point, something along those lines.
So it's a kind of more chaotic...
Hitting out wildly. And I mean, you know, I think the area that he's talking about is, you know, that's actually part of what the war on terror has engendered, in that it turned Al-Qaeda into a kind of franchise, a freewheeling franchise that anybody could pick up on.
And more anger.
Which is, you know, perhaps playing into the hands of what certain people may have wanted to create that kind of global chaos.
Well, Mike, your reaction to his advice to his students, what is his message to these young Yemeni gentlemen who are obviously not Al-Qaeda recruits?
More mixed messages, I think. There is another sequence with the same group of acolytes where he is saying that one of the advantages to come out of 9/11 was that it raised the prices of barrels of oil. And the prop that he's using to illustrate this is a Coca-Cola bottle, the great symbol of Western cultural imperialism. So I think he's committed to some form of social change, but trying to pin him down on the political spectrum is very tricky.
In a way, is he oathless now?
He is oathless, yeah. And in the end, you do sort of come away thinking, well, he's his own man. He's trying... I mean, the driving analogy is very apt, because he's trying to navigate his path through the new world order and not quite getting there. So by the end, he's isolated. He loses his taxi, so even that form of mobility is denied to him. He's you know, distanced even from his own brother-in-law.
Well, Andy, to bring it right up to date, the law incriminating material support, criminalising material support for terrorism, where does that leave us now in regards to American justice? How vague is that? Who could be drawn into that net?
Oh, well, you know, theoretically anybody could be drawn into the net. I mean, when there were discussions about this under Bush, an example that was used by a judge was that a little old lady, she proposed to a US government official, if a little old lady in Switzerland decided to send some money to an organisation that it turned out later was using some of that money to support a terrorist organisation like Al-Qaeda, would she be providing material support? And the representative of the Bush administration said, well, yes, absolutely.
Does that mean journalists could be providing material support for terrorism?
Are we safe?
Theoretically, yes. You know, and I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, the fact is that within the particular contours of the military commission trial system, which has been brought back and which, you know, is underway under Obama, it will be tested. It will be tested in the courts. The courts have recently upheld Hamdan's conviction for providing material support to terrorism, but the discussion is still open as to whether that's
well.
Legal.
This one will have to close, I'm afraid. We have run out of time. I should just say before we go that Salim Hamdan was reunited with his family in January 2009, so there is some kind of ending at least there. Thank you very much. A warm thank you to my guests, Andy Worthington and Mike McCahill, and also thank you. And I hope you'll join us again at the same time next week. But in the meantime, as usual, we'd love to hear your views too. So please do email us at the address on the screen, cinepolitics@presstv.co.uk, or join our Facebook fan page and join the debate with your questions or any suggestions for future films that we could discuss. But thank you, and goodbye for now.